I waited so long in between meals, the doctor said to my mother she didn't force something down when my mouth would heal up.
I wish it had done.
You've been pampered all your life, that's your trouble.
It's the mid-70s, and yet another School of Hard Knocks comic peddles a string of gags about poverty and deprivation and how grim it is up north.
When you were a baby, you had talcum powder. Try to rough it.
Oh, not again.
I was known as Rawhide.
In the hands of your bog-standard, run-of-the-cotton-mill comedian, it's a scene that's practically exhausted. But in the mouth of Les Dawson, it was not only hilarious, it was poetry. Because not only was he one of the truly great comics, but hardship, he knew all about it.
We live in a road called Miracle Road. And the reason why it was called Miracle Road, if the houses stood, it was a miracle. To give you some idea of the way we lived, up to the age of 15, I thought knives and forks were jewellery. But my mother always did her best to give me something nourishing. I've known the times, right, when she's taken the bones from her corsets to give me something nourishing.
He was born on February the 2nd, 1931, in Colliehurst, a part of Manchester yet to be singled out as ripe for redevelopment. The loft apartment conversions and pavement cafe bars serving croissant and latte are conspicuous by their absence. Yuppification isn't in Colliehurst's blood, and it wasn't in Les's either. Professor Geoffrey Richards, lecturer in cultural history at the University of Lancaster.
He was a master of deadpan humour, and I think Lancashire deadpan humour developed as a way of dealing with poverty, unemployment and deprivation in the 30s and 40s. He'd had a very deprived childhood. He then became a star comparatively late on. And I think that deadpan humour, that gloom and doom, which had people in stitches, was rooted very much in the Depression.
To no one's surprise, Les was no great shakes at school. He left at 14, having studiously avoided ever being called swat or teacher's pet, and having displayed a natural aptitude only in pulling stupid faces. Oh, and poetry. He loved poetry. Loved words and the rhythms and rhymes you could make with them. Not that it was of much use to him in his first jobs. No one would consider a working knowledge of the metaphysical poets to be essential for a draper at the co-op or an apprentice electrician. However, he did manage to secure a lowly position where his love of the English language counted for something. He became a cub reporter on the Berry Press. Move over, John Pilger.
I went to cover the funeral of an alderman, I was about 17, a cub reporter. And I had the stub of my pencil and my book, and I was going to be a chaplain pincher. I was going to make my name in journalism. I went to cover this guy's funeral, and I cribbed a piece from when Hindenburg's funeral. The clouds glowered down on the wet, or the tear-stained streets of Koblensk as a funeral cortege. So I did this in modern parlance, and I was so proud. It went about 550,000 words there. So proud of it. And I gave it to the sub-editor. He said, "What a load of crap." He lived and he died, that's all you need to know. So I lost interest then.
So that was that then. Any further career moves were taken out of the young Dawson's hands when he reached the age of 17 and national service beckoned. After being demobbed, employment prospects looked bleak, so Les did what any resourceful back-alley rat-run street-fighting failed electrician would do. He went to Paris to become a writer. If you've ever seen the film The Rebel, where Tony Hancock takes up residence in a garret on the Left Bank to become an abstract artist, you'll get the picture. I believe the term is artistic pretensions. That, or delusions of adequacy.
I was trying to write essays. Things like grimy hunched warehouses, clutching the skyline with dissipated profiles, gazing eyeless upon litter-pitted streets. You know, something like that sort of stuff, which is about as commercial, really, as trying to do fiddle on the roof in Iraq.
Money didn't come easy. He was broke and had to supplement his income in other ways.
I wandered down this Monsieur Le Prince, which is a small winding street off Odeon in Paris on the Left Bank. And I walked in, there was a beautiful piano there. I started playing, so this madam came out. She was a big woman, you know, she looked a reddish dress and a flat hat, and I thought it was a pillar box of her. And she said, in an imitable French, which I found out after I met the L.A.U., because I didn't know that was there, because I was still in English. So she offered me a job playing the piano, you see, late night. For about, in those days, they had inflation pretty bad, for about 5,000 francs, which meant it was about 10 quid, to be honest. Yeah. And nobody ever came in. There was a barman. And the bar was a bit dirty. It looks as though it had been backcombed. Not many cobwebs. They filled the cabinet with this very nice piano and this woman, Eva, who used to supply me with cheap wine, which was very nice. But nobody ever came in, and I realised I was a front for the brothel at the back.
Having failed to become a celebrated existentialist, Les Dawson became the next best thing, a door-to-door salesman. But the days spent trudging the streets of Moss Side, flogging a few quids with a vacuum cleaner to people who didn't have two halfpennies to rub together, were to prove time well spent for the future. Every salesman needs patter, and patter was what Les did best. He knew he could get laughs with his rubber face and tales of the backstreet lives of drunken henpecked husbands and their formidable beehived wives and hatchet-faced harridan mothers-in-law. He started to work the clubs. He got an opportunity knocks. But crucially, he wrote to the BBC. Former Beeb Light Entertainment producer, Mike Craig.
He wrote a letter to James Casey, the head of BBC Light Entertainment in Manchester, and Jim Casey rang me up one day and said, do you want to come and see a man called Les Dawson with me? He's working a club in Oldham. I said, yes, I've never heard of him. He said, he was on Opportunity Knocks last week. Oh, I said, I didn't see it last week. Well, he said, I rather like the letter he's written to me. And he read it out. He said, I have recently returned from a tour of the African rainforests, appearing with Martha Haggerty's Romany Trombone Dwarfs. Jim Casey said, anybody who I've never heard of who can write stuff like that is worth seeing.
Despite this vote of confidence, Les found it tough going. Jim Casey.
The audiences didn't want him in the early days. They used to come to my office in Manchester and he'd say, I'm packing it in, I'm going back to selling Hoovers. And I used to say, then, you are going to be a very big star. And he'd say, but they paid me off on Monday night. And I said, yes, I know, but they didn't come to see you. And one day, when they paid to see you, they will sit there and listen to your long stories and fall about. And at the moment, they just throw chairs at you. But it'll happen. And, of course, it did.
Eventually. But if Les lost patience with the audience, he never lost faith in the language. He wrote and wrote and wrote, taking snapshots of life in the shadows of the gasometers and weaving them with rich vocabulary into surreal monologues peppered with masterful one-liners. Performing partner, Roy Barraclough.
Les wrote most of his own material, certainly the stand-up stuff, the off-the-wall stuff, Les wrote himself. I think, looking back, I think he was very much ahead of his time, if we think in terms of 25 years ago. This sort of surreal sort of material was very, very new, and quite often it used to play to complete silence in the studio because the audience is thinking, what the hell's he on about, you know?
And Les knew the origins and traditions of what made a great gag. He just took it that bit further. Jim Casey.
He loved old English novels, and he would get a phrase from one, and he'd love it. And I remember him one day saying to me, listen to this, Jim, isn't this wonderful? I will render you hors de combat with a ball from my horse pistol. He said, now isn't that fabulous, you know? I won't shoot you. I'm going to render you hors de combat. And so he always used these kind of phrases, and the fact that he had put them with ordinary everyday things, like the wife and the mother-in-law, that's what made him so different.
And I just happened to glance at the night sky, and I marvelled at the millions of stars glistening like pieces of crystal that thrown carelessly onto black velvet. In awe, I watched the waxen moon ride like an amber chariot across the zenith of the heavens, towards the ebon void of infinite space, wherein the tethered bolts of Jupiter and Mars hang forever festooned in their orbital majesty. As I looked at all this, I thought, I must put a roof on this laboratory.
That's the distilled essence of Dawson. The working-class gutter-snipe comedy, interwoven with the dexterous wordplay of the cultured gentleman. It was as if his intellectualism was an embarrassment, and had to be deconstructed to avoid appearing snooty. Well-read, he may very well have been, but a mother-in-law gag was never far away.
I woke up panic-stricken, the wife was still asleep, just like a baby, with a big toe in her mouth. I got out of bed. I went to the mother-in-law's bedroom. She didn't see me. She was listening to a record of Hitler's speeches.
Professor Geoffrey Richards.
When Les Dawson did mother-in-law jokes, he was, in a sense, sending up the convention. When other people do mother-in-law jokes, they do them seriously because they're using the mother-in-law as a kind of dragon. But I think he did it with a twinkle in his eye. I think he was saying, these are old-fashioned jokes, and I'm sending them up, and I'm sharing with you the fact that I'm sending them up. I think he had that extra subtle level to him.
Well, she's too big for a bikini. I'm not saying she's fat, but she used to be a detail for a whaling fleet. She's the only woman I know that gets her knickers on a prescription. She hasn't got elastic in the drawers, it's swish rail.
He wasn't what you might call a feminist, wasn't Les? But he respected women. He understood their power and influence over the lives of mere men.
Women, generally, are much better at control of things than men are. I mean, really, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world is still a great axiom, despite the fact that feminists say they're not going to have a fair deal. Women are still very powerful, most powerful. And they always take a centre point, like the mother-in-law is the centre of the family. Wives and all that. So I think most men hide behind the air of bravado. It's basically a defence mechanism, isn't it? Clever creatures, very clever.
My wife is a very beautiful woman with a very interesting left eye. The right one keeps looking at it. She can be full of changes and surprises. The other morning she gave me breakfast in bed. It slid off the plate when she threw it. I didn't mind. There was something strangely erotic about poached egg on quilt. You see, I haven't spoken to the wife for 5 years. It's not that we've had a row, it's just I'm not quick enough to interrupt.
Not quick enough to interrupt. It's a very good gag, but it's all the better for following the surreal domestic image of poached egg on quilt. Women were the butt of lots of Les's jokes, but he was unrepentant. He wasn't having a go. He was making cartoons.
I mean, nobody could take the remarks, surely, seriously. Well, I used to say that she was a decoy for a whaling fleet. And the skin stretches to such an extent when she bends her knees, her eyelids fly open. I mean, come on, that's so extensionist. It's ridiculous to even believe that it's been derogative. I mean, this is a cartoon, Kessel Lampoon. It's basically an affection anyway. I mean, I don't pull anything to pieces that I don't like. Things I don't like, I ignore. Things I'm fond of, I make fun of.
Thursday night, never slept a wink. I kept getting this hideous recurrent nightmare that I was a piece of loose machinery. And the wife was chasing me with a spanner saying, come here while I tighten your nuts. Now the wife's playing out, she wants a new dress, and I wouldn't care, there's nothing wrong with the one she's got. All it needs is the sleeve shortening and the swastika taken off.
Throughout the 60s, Les was a fixture on the radio, on programmes such as Workers' Playtime and Midday Music Hall. But when the 70s arrived, you were either on the telly or you were nobody. Says Les hit the screens right at the start of the decade, and apart from anything else, gave Les the chance to develop one of the truly great comic partnerships, as he joined forces with Roy Barraclough to create Sissy and Ada.
Well, Sissy and Ada started about 25 years ago. We were working for Yorkshire Television at the time, doing the very first Says Les series. During the breaks in the studio, waiting for lighting, and Les and I used to go into this routine because Les was a great fan of Norman Evans, and indeed I was. So we used to go into this routine, and Les would say things like, ooh, do you know, you get more light off a 40-watt Mazda. And so on and so forth. And the producer at the time, a lovely man called Bill Hitchcock, said, that's a marvellous idea. Why don't we do that as a sketch in the show in drag, you know? And we said, oh, come on, the public aren't ready to see us two in frocks, for God's sake. But he said, well, let's try it as a warm-up. And indeed, we did a couple of weeks doing it as a warm-up for the studio audience. And it went down so well that we decided to feature it as a sketch in the show.
Here, let me freshen up your cup of tea, Ed, love. And do try a piece of my home-baked Wiltshire herbal flan.
Thank you, Joe. It's very nice, this. Very spicy.
Are you and Bert coming across tonight for a game of cards?
Yes, yes.
Leonard suggested that we have a little kaluki.
Oh, that'd be nice. It's years since me and Bert had a bit of dookie.
It's certainly true that there were women like that in Lancashire. I was related to several. And sitting on the ottoman in the back parlour of my grandma's house in Farnworth, it was a toss-up whether to concentrate on Sissy and Ada on the box, or to watch me gran and Florrie Danson hitch up their ample bosoms, rummage for senior service in the pockets of their nylon housecoats, and mouth something about having trouble downstairs. You know, waterworks.
It did look nice going out the other night. It looked lovely.
Oh, thank you, Ada Chirk. Yes, my Leonard bought me that two-piece, you know, from Shea Brenda's in Canal Street. And that pink blouse with the organdy flounce I got from Madame Sheba's.
Oh, very nice.
She's a bit on the expensive side, yes. You know, but she's very exclusive.
Oh. Where did you go?
Well, we went to the hunting lodge.
Oh.
Yeah. And we dined al fresco.
I don't like Italian food. That's like opening medicine on me.
Oh. Really, honestly, al fresco means in the open air.
Oh,
you know, sort of eating outside.
Oh, yes.
You know, we started with consomme.
Yeah, mother with soup.
The gags are pure Dawson, and the observations meticulous. Sissy may not have had a great life, but at least it's been better than Ada's. At least Sissy has dined al fresco and shopped at Shea Brenda. At least she knows that consomme is posh soup, so she's one up on Ada. Somehow, though, it's Ada's complete ignorance and lack of artifice that make her so endearing. It puts me in mind of me gran who, when we took our first foreign family holiday in Spain, said, "Ooh, I wouldn't fancy going there. All that bloody curry." You loved her all the more for coming out with that, but you had to laugh. You had to laugh.
Les's raison d'etre was to make me laugh, and he would go to any lengths to try and make me laugh on camera. He was quite mischievous, you see. I did a theatre season with him at Blackpool, and we did a Sissy and Ada routine in the show, set in a tea shop, where we had to have a cup of tea. He was pouring tea. And he used to withdraw from up his knicker leg a little hip flask, and he used to say, "Have a drop of this in your tea, Sissy, you'll enjoy it," you see. Every single performance, he used to find some terrible noxious liquid to put in this hip flask, ranging from like 100% vodka to herbal remedies and all sorts of foul things, which he made me drink, you see, and used to twinkle and hope that I would corpse, you see, but I very bravely used to go on with this routine and defy him. At one particular time I had terrible flu. So Les was very fond of a drop of scotch, you see. So he plied me with scotch and said, "This will be good for you for the flu, you see." And I was sort of reeling with this scotch as I went on to do the second house. It came to the tea shop sketch. And in the cup he poured this red syrupy liquid. And I thought, what the hell's he got now? And it was Benylin. Well, the combination of the scotch and the Benylin, I mean, I was comatose. I couldn't make the finale because I couldn't negotiate the steps. So they had to pour me out of the theatre in a taxi. I had to leave my car and everything. He was quite wicked, quite wicked.
Sloshed on whiskey as well. The parallels with my gran are uncanny. But if the on-stage partnership with Roy Barraclough was vital, off-stage, the biggest influence was his wife, Meg. And she was quite an imposing woman, was Meg. Jim Casey.
When he was writing once, and the fella I know was there, and she came in and said, "I thought you were going to fix that tap on the bath." He said, "Yeah, well, I'm done." She said, "You're sitting there, go and do it." "All right, Meg." And he went on and fixed the tap. They came down and continued writing. And then she came in and said, "It's 4:15. Go and pick the kids up." "Oh, all right." And off he went. This fella couldn't believe it.
Les and Meg raised 3 kids. And apart from being a wife, she was the inspiration behind lots of his material. She might have frightened him a bit, but she could also be quite dizzy.
He once did a command show at Windsor Castle. Meg was allowed to go as a guest, he said, and afterwards, at the party afterwards, he said, to his horror, he saw Meg talking to the Queen. and nodding furiously and pointing in various directions. You see, and they thought, oh my God, what is she saying? So afterwards they said, so you're talking to the Queen, what did she say? But she said, I just asked her what the central heating was. And she said, I really don't know. And she said, well, you want to go on gas. She said, you want to get all those gaps under the doors filled in, she said, because you lose a lot of heat that way, you know, which was wonderful.
Discussing central heating with the Queen. Pure Sissy and Ada. During the 80s, The Les Dawson Show was one of TV's top-rated programmes, featuring, as it did, Les's celebrated creation, the Roly-Polies. To all intents and purposes, Sissy and Ada in tap shoes. Beryl Cook meets Riverdance. In 1987, though, tragedy struck when Meg died after a six-year battle with cancer. Les, devastated, dealt with it the only way he knew how. He drank, and smoked, and ate, and worked, and paid for it. After months of burning the candle at both ends, his kidneys packed up in 1985 whilst recording Blankety Blank. He survived, just. In 1989, though, to everyone's surprise, he got married again. To Tracy. To them, he was the sad old soak lusting after younger women. The press had a field day, but Les wasn't going to let the hacks spoil it.
I mean, for a start, what it's got to do with other people, I just don't know. I mean, I don't believe this, but, oh, well, you're in the public eye, you're private now, private life is my life. I found happiness again, which I didn't think I would. Nobody sets out 4 o'clock in the morning and says, I'm going to get married again. I didn't think it would happen, but it did. And I was grateful about it. Everybody's happy for us. And the press then turned in our favour. They realised there was no scandal attached to it. I think they were trying to find, but they wasn't. Quite boring, really, you know. I mean, my press a full-blooded scandal might give me something to do now, but there's no scandal.
And as for Tracy, yes, he drank. Yes, he was fat. Yes, he had a face like a bag of spanners. But she could see beyond that. For her, he was a kind, caring man.
He always had a lot of time for people. If we were working at the theatre and there'd be a young comic on the show, he'd leave the dressing room door open and say, I heard that gag tonight, you know, perhaps try it another way. He always had time and he shared a lot. But he always remembered how hard it was for him coming up in the business. I think with all walks of life, he had a lot of compassion, and I think that's why he was so loved and liked.
And that was the whole point for Les. Just because you'd become famous, it didn't make you special. Just because you'd met the Queen, it didn't mean you couldn't talk about central heating. What he despised most were people who thought they were better than you. The sissies of this world. Dawson was forever with the Adas.
The only thing I ever knew that made him angry was if somebody was talking down to somebody else, or was being big-headed, or in some way attacking somebody who couldn't really defend themselves. Like a big star having a go at a smaller act, sort of thing. Now that would make him very angry. He would have a real go at them.
But if he distrusted stardom, he wasn't above a bit of rock and roll behaviour. He was always late, and he was always on the whiskey. In fact, recording schedules had to be altered to curb his boozing time. Jim Casey.
We used to record 2 shows at a time, and we started off rehearsing at 12:30, have a break for lunch, and then carry on rehearsing till 7. But in order to cut down the possible drinking time, we finished up meeting at 4 o'clock to rehearse 2 shows and do them at 8. And he still managed to get to the bar at 7 o'clock, and I had coming out at about 8:05 while I was doing the warm-up. And then he'd walk round the circle and sort of heckle me as he came in. And it never seemed to affect his performance. That was an incredible thing.
Les loved to indulge. Perhaps it was his upbringing. If you didn't know where your next meal was coming from, it made sense to pig out while there was food on the table. If you were down to your last couple of quid, you may as well spend it on booze, because there was no telling when you'd be able to get tanked up again. The heart trouble kept recurring, though, and eventually even Les listened to the doctors. And of course, he had a new family to think about. Tracy and Les had a daughter, Charlotte Emily, born in 1992. Les was besotted, but wouldn't live to see her first birthday. Yes, he'd stopped drinking, Yes, he'd stopped smoking, but he couldn't cure his real addiction. He couldn't stop working.
He always used to think, gosh, I'll just do this last pantomime, or I'll just do this last summer show, because you never know, we might run out of money. I think he always felt, you know, the working class side of Les was, you know, it could come back tomorrow, we could lose everything, and I'll just do this last show. But I don't think it would have ever been his last. He would have always worked, really.
Les Dawson suffered a fatal heart attack on June the 10th, 1993. Ironically, whilst visiting hospital for a routine checkup. If he'd been able to slow down, he might have been with us today, but that's academic. Les was never going to slow down.
I just don't think Les could have ever given up. I mean, he talked about possibly directing pantos and producing them and concentrate on his writing, because he was a very successful writer. And it would have been nice if he could be here today, and, you know, but it didn't happen. And he lived his life to the full, and I think he had a wonderful life, really.
Like Eric Morecambe and Tommy Cooper, Les Dawson was a part of living in Britain in the 70s and 80s. I watched them all with me grandad, and I can still see me and the old fella laughing there in the armchair in front of the 3-bar electric fire in the back kitchen at Lobelia Avenue. Me grandad died, as grandads do, but when Les died, it was like his mate had gone too. Roy Barraclough knows that feeling only too well.
Every day I think about him. At some point of the day, something happens where I think, oh God, Les would have loved that, or that reminds me of Les, or whatever, you know. And certainly now when I'm a great one for eavesdropping on conversations in cafes and on buses and things, and when I hear two women talking to each other on a bus, I think, oh God, that would have been lovely for Les and I, you know, for Sissy and Ada.
He was a truly brilliant comedian, was Les Dawson, but he was more than that. He was a chronicler of life in the North. His observations tell you as much as any archive photograph, and the fact that it's funny doesn't mean it's not social history. It might have to be embellished, but there's no rule against a joke telling the truth.
I boarded the grime smeared and vandalised Shalabang with some trepidation. On the way, we lost several passengers in nuts for two pensioners escaped, just as Morris dancers. And one cut a hole in the rear of the coach and ran to phone the Good Samaritans. But to anybody who considers going abroad and is frightened because of the language problem, don't worry. We had no trouble. Nobody spoke to us. Adios, amigos!